Welcome back to the Door County Pulse podcast. I'm Miles Danhausen Jr., and we got three topics coming your way today. One is we have a big election coming up for local elections in April. We'll talk about that and some of the things to watch for later in the podcast. But there's also a couple of big pieces of news for local municipalities getting some more money for broadband and some interesting stuff around the Coast Guard in Sturgeon Bay. And here to talk to me about all these issues is Deborah Fitzgerald, our editor here at The Pulse. Welcome back, Deborah.
Hello, Miles.
Let's start with the Coast Guard. What's going on? They gave up on rescuing ice fishermen and they're leaving the county, right?
Right. Hopefully there won't be any additional ice rescues this year. I think the water is pretty open, but
who knows?
You never know.
And there might be some ice fisherman who sees like an 8-foot square block and is like, I'm putting my shanty on there. I'm getting my time in. I'm floating out there.
Right. So this is kind of an interesting story because it really started in January. I was talking with Jeff Feierstein. He's an auxiliary member, a Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard auxiliary member. And he was pitching the idea of doing a story on the auxiliary. And, you know, I know nothing about the volunteer auxiliary and their uniformed volunteers. And, you know, Door County has 300 miles of shoreline, and we have about 4,000 plus boat piers. So it really is a very hot spot for boating. And so the auxiliary becomes more important because they do boat safety checks and things like that. So they really help the Coast Guard out a lot. So I decided I would do a story on that because I didn't think many people knew about it. And so I contacted the Sturgeon Bay Coast Guard Station and talked to Petty Officer First Class Taylor Barnes. And he was talking about how important the auxiliary is. But then he shared with me the recruitment problems that the Coast Guard is having. So I started digging into that a little bit more deeply. And he said that they have been given flexibility in how to maintain their current operations with less. And so what they decided to do was not open the seasonal Washington Island Coast Guard station this year and also the small Green Bay station. So all operations this season are going to be handled out of the Sturgeon Bay Coast Guard Station. Normally they have 36 crew members there and they're down to about 24. But this is across the entire country. It's not just here. So the U.S. Coast Guard has indicated that they are 10% down in personnel. Normally they have about 55,000. They're actually grounding boats, you know, cutters. They're not manned or not personneled. And it's becoming really kind of dire for them.
Wow.
And so they are amending operations all over the country, and that's just one of the changes that they are making here. So Washington Island got wind of this from U.S. Congressman Gallagher's office, and they are a little bit concerned because they're not sure what expectations will be placed upon local emergency personnel in the absence of U.S. Coast Guard personnel. Now,
and they're the only large island community in the state.
Yeah.
So and they have a very unique perspective on this.
Well, and also, I mean, Taylor, at the Coast Guard station, he told me that it will take, you know, about an hour and a half to get to the upper reaches of the territory that they have as an area of responsibility outside of Sturgeon Bay, around Sturgeon Bay. And it's one of the largest areas that the U.S. Coast Guard has. So without the Washington Island station, an hour and a half. And he said that's like really booking it, you know, if they go really fast to get up there. So they are going to be relying upon, you know, the Good Samaritan law that enables boaters to assist while the U.S. Coast Guard is en route. And they also will be leaning a lot more on the auxiliary as well. So they have a plan in place to be able to assure that they're still doing their duty, but Washington Island, Hans Lux, the town chair there, is who I spoke with. He's going to be sitting down with the Coast Guard in April so that they can kind of go over what's going to happen.
Yeah, how does this all shake out?
Yeah. So that is, I mean, I think it's across all military branches. It's not just the U.S. Coast Guard. That recruitment is down. There aren't enough bodies, you know, to be able to fill the positions that we have in the military.
When does this all happen?
Well, it will for this season. So okay. They won't be opening the Washington Island small station there.
So aside from the time of response, did they say anything else about like how they expect this to impact the average person?
They really did not. He did not think that it would at all.
Okay.
I mean, he really did say that the response time, of course, is going to be elongated. But other than that, he really did not think that there was going to be much of an impact. I got some statistics from him. And for instance, during their last calendar year, they had 56 search and rescue operations. And most of the time, it's because people have run out of gas or they've broken down in some way in the water. So it's not as if it's an emergency that, you know, there's somebody, you know, drowning. There were no fatalities, sure. For instance. So I'm not making light of it and saying that there aren't dangers out there in right. The water that they respond to. But he did say that's their number one thing. And so that's why the auxiliary is so important, because they do these boat safety checks. So the more that they're able to check a boat at the beginning of the season and give it a sticker and say you're all set, then the safer, you know, the waterways are.
And I'm thinking of, like, when there are those major incidents, that usually commands a large multi-agency response anyway, like your fire departments, your police departments. They're sending, like, most of our fire departments have their, I shouldn't say most, I don't know that for a fact, but our fire departments are equipped with rescue boats and things like that they can deploy. And then if it is a major search, I think they're usually bringing a helicopter in from Traverse City anyway. So that's not like a local search, or at least a lot of times it's Traverse City. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, it makes you concerned for, we're probably uniquely positioned to care about this, because if you're sitting in a lot of these lakeside communities, you're just one community on this bay, but like in, you know, obviously we're just surrounded on all sides, so it provides like just so much more ground to cover.
And and it's astonishing, like I don't even really ever think about the U.S. Coast Guard and what they're doing out there, but I mean, they're law enforcement, they are, you know, everything, patrolling the waters out there, and I just never even think of it
until you're sitting on a boat on like Memorial Day weekend or the 4th of July and you start to notice them doing boat checks everywhere.
Yes.
Safety vests? How many do we have?
and that's an interesting thing. I think he said that they, and I'm just quoting this from memory, it's in the story in this week's Pulse, but I think he said they boarded 381 vessels, and they are not allowed to board fewer than the year before. So it's kind of a standard that the Coast Guard has. So they have,
Have they changed that standard?
No, they haven't, which is kind of interesting. So they will do, you know, this major effort around 4th of July and those kinds of things. But
so I would just go to like marinas every week and just go, all right, like walk on 45 boats here.
Yeah, right. I mean, so, but ice rescues are increasingly, you know, what they launch for, of course.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting, and this is just an aside, but at a county committee meeting yesterday, or a couple days ago, they were talking about, and this is in the Pulse too, they were floating the idea of coming up with an ordinance and fees for ice rescues so that they can recapture some of the costs of deploying so many different emergency response units to be able to respond to these.
Do they have a number, like what it costs to do a single?
No, and they had,
because I know a helicopter ride from Sturgeon Bay to the hospital is billed out at like $5,000. So.
Right. And Aaron LeClaire, who, you know, heads up emergency services for the county, he was saying that they're not able to charge anybody because there's nobody to charge. So what they're looking at is ordinances that other counties may have, but also to maybe charge guide services need DNR licenses. And captains need U.S. Coast Guard licenses. Hmm. So they're thinking about maybe attaching some kind of fee schedule, you know, to that and coming up with some kind of an ordinance for that. But it's at the very beginning discussion stages only. And Chief Deputy Pat McCarty brought up, you know, this has been a problem for years, but you need to balance, like, they don't want people not to call 911.
Right.
Because they don't want to have to pay the fee, and they don't want to have to be dinged on their license or whatever that is going to take. So it's not as simple as it may seem.
That's a great point. Like, even bringing it up might be putting a little, like a hair more caution.
Right.
Amongst the guide services and people who maybe do that commercially. I'm not trying to paint them with a bad brush or anything, but like any business, if they're like, well, the health department might come down on you if you serve your burger this way.
Yeah.
So you start serving it a different way. You
know? I agree.
So that's kind of maybe what that will do.
Right. So anyway, that's that.
Well, we'll take a short break here, and then we'll come back and talk about the latest round of broadband money that is coming the peninsula's way. Hey, listeners. Do you love the Door County Pulse podcast and want to support the work that we do? Well, head on over to DoorCountyPulse.com and click on the shop button in the top menu. There, you can purchase Door County Parks posters, Door County Lighthouse posters, postcards, photo books, and more. You can also subscribe to the Peninsula Pulse. Yep, that sounds crazy because you probably already get the Pulse for free because we mail it to every mailbox in Door County and put it on newsstands throughout the peninsula. But when you buy a subscription for just $52 a year, you'll help support the work of the journalists whose reporting informs so much of this podcast and everything that we do. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Door County Pulse podcast. All right, we're back. Deb, broadband. You haven't covered this at all over the last few years.
No, I haven't.
It's been a pretty quiet thing. So, yeah, there's more money coming our way, huh?
Well, the final money that was coming from the state, well, via the state. This is actually U.S. Department of Treasury money. But it was, you know, allocated by Governor Tony Evers. So there was $40 million remaining, and the application process started last year. But anyway, there were 30 projects funded, and three of those projects were in Door County. We actually had 11 applications for this money out of Door County, which Jessica Hatch, the Door County Broadband Coordinator, said was the highest number of applications for any county. So that's really good. We're being very proactive here in all of our municipalities. But the three that received money, one of them I'm really happy about because I live in Sevastopol. So the town of Egg Harbor received $960,000. Okay. So that's going to be going toward their fiber to the premises project, which is a $7.6 million project. The town of Sevastopol received $816,000, and that is going to go toward their $6.6 million project. And then the town of Sturgeon Bay received $552,000, and that will go toward their $4.4 million project. Now, the interesting thing about all three of those is that they are all partnered with AT&T.
Oh.
So AT&T submitted all of these applications on behalf of those.
So maybe AT&T has really good grant writers?
Yeah, and, you know, it is a legacy company.
Yeah.
So it does actually have infrastructure already on the ground, you know, and for my landline that I need because I don't have cell service at my house is an AT&T landline. So
aside from the island, which brought some stuff online recently, if I think of this like a race to be the first one to actually like complete a project, is there a sense of like, when is this going to be turned on for some of these municipalities?
I think that it will be done over years, over a couple of years. I know that for a fact. So I think it's really hard to say because, for instance, Bailey's Harbor. I mean, we would have thought that Bailey's Harbor would have been done by now, right?
Right.
But it's not. And so we don't really know what is stalling that, but with...
Is this the town chairman's fault? Sorry, Dave, had to get a little knock on you there. No. I know it's not. It's not Dave's fault.
It's hard to say, but I would, like, for Sevastopol, for instance, they are connecting 1,749 residential homes and 159 business locations. So I think it really depends on how much infrastructure they already have that exists there. So I would not venture to guess who would be turned on first.
And then you just think of like how much of a pain it is to get, you know, the cable company to come out in general.
So, yeah. And then, you know, so some of the municipalities are really moving forward, and then others are really hitting some roadblocks. Like, I know the village of Egg Harbor just... you know, learn that their costs with the partner that they had selected are going to be prohibitive. And so they might be doing some backtracking there. But so it's not, this money is significant only because it's the last money that is going to be coming down before the BEAD money, the federal money that's allocated to Wisconsin. And that money, that $1 billion, is not going to be like a traditional grant. It's going to be, you know, more of an auction type thing, because it needs to go to the places absolutely that are underserved, basically, and, so or not served.
Sister-based redundant system isn't going to get that money.
No, that would not be it. So, yeah, so it is good that, you know, we are making progress with some municipalities.
It is. The reason I talked about, like, that guess at who might get it first, because, you know, when this started, and it really started early in COVID, the discussion, because people were suddenly working from home and learning from home. And then,
or from parking lots.
Yeah, and people saw these huge gaps in kind of the equity of, mm-hmm. you know, a kid in a certain area had great access to internet, and a kid in a rural area had little to none. But so then by 2021, people were starting to move fast on this. Grant money was getting allocated. Some towns buying hook, line, and sinker, like, yeah, we think by the end of 23 or like 24, we're going to be online. And I'm sitting here going, I don't think that's going to happen, but sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess this is what you're saying. But I it's just to the effect of, like, I mean, this stuff just always, the hurdles that people are having and the backtracking that's happening in certain communities with different providers is, like, for us, when we talk about it, we totally expect that to happen. Mm. But it's interesting, right, when some of these town board, no, it's all good. They said they can do it. I'm like, they've been saying that for 30 years.
Yeah, so. It always becomes so much clearer after the fact, because all of these different providers that you'd never even heard of just started flocking to these areas because suddenly there was so much money available.
Yeah.
And that became part of the problem, actually, because, you know, which ones are viable? Which ones are real? Well, it's turning out that it's those that, you know, we recognize.
Right. Yeah. You know, going back to, like, Brilliant Cities 20 some years ago,
oh,
and
right.
their big proposal here. Mm-hmm. We're going to do fiber in the whole county for $5 million.
Right.
yeah. How? Have you heard of Rock?
Yes.
Because that's what we have. Anyway. Well, good news for those three communities, and hopefully people are getting much better internet very soon, probably moderately soon.
Yes, hopefully.
All right, we're going to take one more break, and then we're going to come back and give everybody a little preview of the April 2nd election. The Door County Pulse podcast is brought to you in part by the Door County Medical Center. Are you looking for a job with excellent benefits, culture, and potential for advancement through tuition reimbursement programs? Door County Medical Center is hiring. For more than 75 years, Door County Medical Center has been the leader in health and wellness for Door and Kewaunee counties. Their integrated medical center provides a wide range of specialties, including primary care, behavioral health, general surgery, the Women and Children's Center, the Door Orthopedic Center, the Door County Cancer Center, and more. To join the team, apply today at dcmedical.org/careers. Okay, Deb, small election cycle coming up. This has been really easy for you to put together. I know this took you like a couple hours to throw together some questionnaires.
Yeah, no problem.
How many contested races do we have on the ballot, or how many candidates?
We have 36 candidates in contested races.
Okay.
So we have races on the Door County Board of Supervisors, the Door County Circuit Court Branch 1, because Judge Ehlers is retiring, the Sturgeon Bay Common Council, the Bailey's Harbor Town Board, the Gardner Town Board, the Sevastopol Town Board, the Sister Bay Village Board, and the Washington Town Board. And then we also have, at two of our five school districts, we have contested races.
Okay.
That's at Southern Door and at Sturgeon Bay. So it came out to 36 different people that we reached out to with questionnaires, and only one of them decided not to participate. I don't know if that was the decision or not, but one person did not participate, which I consider to be fabulous. That is just a really, really awesome ratio. And I would say 95% of the people met the deadline, and people were very cooperative. And it's really important, because we get so many I think it probably started about 3 weeks ago with people emailing me or texting me. When is it coming? When are you guys going to be talking to the candidates? When is it coming out? I mean, that's the only way that you can find out anything about these candidates. So we have a special election section in this week's paper, and you will be able to find information on every one of those candidates in your races in that.
For the listeners, like when you were talking about like how many people respond, you'd think if you're running for office, you would automatically like want to respond and send stuff in, but it does take some reminders, some badgering. Luckily, email today is and text message makes it a little easier than 15 years ago when I'd say like half the contestants, when you would suggest sending an email ballot to them, they'd say, I don't have an email, or maybe I could send it to my son or something like that.
Oh, man, that's right.
And that would be brutal. And then you'd have to snail mail and then try to transcribe their handwriting. But like,
and they didn't have photos, and so they'd have to start. Yes, it is definitely a lot easier now than it used to be.
But yeah, it is. It takes a lot of work to get all this information from everybody. And then you have to try and present it in a way that is as fair and unbiased as possible. So sometimes when you get a response back and it's one person writes up to the word count limit that we give them and the other person gives you two word answers, it looks like you're trying to frame it a certain way. But like, so there's all these things that we grapple with of trying to make this as fair as possible, but then also try to give voters information that matters to them.
Yeah. Right?
Because with that many different races, and each community is a little bit different, so you try to frame some questions that can provide some consistency. And how do you go about trying to figure out, like, what do I want to ask these people that will give voters at least a high-level glimpse of what they care about?
Sure. Fortunately, we kind of have a bead on what's going on with a lot of the municipalities up here. So some of their hot-button issues we're already aware of. So for, you know, Kevin Bineski covers certain beats and Craig Sterrett covers certain beats. And so we kind of collaborated to come up with some questions on some of their beats. And for some of those, I would say there weren't very many generic questions because we did know what was going on for most of those, for most of the municipalities that, that have something happening. The district court judge, I did a lot of research on that one, so that was probably the hardest one for me to come up with questions on, because I'm not accustomed to, you know, the questions that would be relevant. But I think that I think I did a good job of it. And so and I did send them actually to some legal advisors to find out. I sent probably about 10 questions to a couple of legal advisors and said, what do you think of these questions? You know, should I elaborate on this or that? And so I got some good advice on that, too. Yeah. So those questions were the most difficult. The others, we pretty much knew what was going on. So I want to say that everybody had the opportunity to answer each one of the questions in 75 words or less. That's really important to note because each one of those questions had that limit on it. Mm-hmm. So as you alluded to, Miles, you know, some people do write to the limit of that. I can tell you that probably 80% of the people were like right at 75 words on a lot of those. But then others, you know, were very much under that. And it could be that some misconstrued the instructions and thought 75 words total for all of the questions. I don't know. But I do think that the answers are thoughtful and all of the candidates took them seriously, and I think that voters will be able to make some good decisions if they take a look at them.
Who are your least favorite candidates?
The most difficult ones to deal with.
Are there any races, aside from the fact that people are actually willing to run to step into the Southern Door school board situation given the last couple of years there? No, but seriously, good on those people because they've had a lot of controversy to deal with, and it's good to see people actually running and having a contested race there to step into that and help clean things up, I suppose.
Well, it was really kind of cool because you do have always a younger demographic that runs for the school board seats.
Yeah.
Can considering the, you know, they have a vested interest. Their children are in school.
They're basically me. They're 40 to 48, and they have a kid in school.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple of younger people who have entered the race in Sturgeon Bay.
Oh, excellent.
So challenging some, you know, incumbents there. So that's kind of cool. At the county level,
The worst school board candidates, by the way, are the ones who, like, it's one thing, like, you get interested in the school when your kid's there. That makes sense. The worst ones are the ones that are like, I don't like that coach. I will run for board. Or I don't like this one policy. Because those people last one term.
Well, you remember during COVID.
Oh.
Those were the hottest races ever. I mean, there were like people who 20 have never, people running.
People who have never said one word about education or researched anything about school funding in their life suddenly cared a ton about mass.
Right.
And we haven't heard from them since.
Like, right. On the county board, there are a couple of races. But the one that is really kind of concerning is District 19, which covers several Northern Door communities. And that's Dave Lee now. He is the chair of the county board. And he is retiring, so he's not running, and nobody has filed to run for that seat. So that seat is going to be decided by a write-in candidate, most likely. And county clerks are a little concerned about that because people sometimes don't take the write-in portion of the ballot seriously, and they'll write things like Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck, and after a 14-hour day, that's the last thing that clerks want to have to see because all of those write-in ballots get kicked out. You know, I mean, they're kicked into a different bin, and so they do have
Say that they don't get eliminated
from
the
vote
count. Let's not say kicked out. That's maybe the bad phrasing.
Yes.
They just get put in a different pile.
Right, okay. A different pile. So they're sorted differently. And so those have to be looked at, you know, by each and everyone has to be looked at. So they're a little concerned about that because there are so many municipalities that are involved with that. So be kind to your poll workers.
As you think about that with that county board supervisor seat for Dave Lienau's seat, that would touch on Liberty Grove, Sister Bay.
Bailey's Harbor, Ephraim.
Wow. Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, so all of Northern Door.
It's not just that, like, the Liberty Grove Town Hall, they have to worry about this. This is four different clerks.
Exactly. Right.
That'll be fun.
Right. So be kind to your poll worker on April 2, which is when the election is. And then, of course, we have on the election the presidential preference. But, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter to us anymore.
Yeah, we're so late in the game. I wonder if that'll even affect turnout at this point.
I don't know. I mean, but there are still a number of Republican candidates. There are two presidential Democratic candidates, and there are still four of the Republican candidates. Now, they can remove their name from ballots. They can have their name removed, but a lot of them quit the race after that deadline, so they're still going to be on the ballot.
And now, potentially, I guess, you know, with Aaron Rodgers maybe running as a VP, changed the whole race now that we've got the brilliance in there. So anyway,
lots
sure
to look
Aaron
forward to.
I'm sure he'd be great at it.
Is that a real thing?
That seems like a real thing.
Wow.
I'm sure it's real in Aaron's head.
That is crazy.
I talk about him in his first name like I know the guy.
Who is the baseball player in California?
Steve Garvey?
Yeah, Steve Garvey.
Yeah.
So if Steve can do it, then Aaron can? Maybe.
Well, if Tommy Tuberville can be a senator, that chair I'm sitting next to can be a senator. But
well, see, now you're really talking over my head.
Yeah.
Is that a sports guy,
too? It's an old football coach here.
Oh, okay.
In the South, football coaches are king. Nick Saban could run for governor in any state in the Southeastern Conference and be elected probably tomorrow.
Really?
With no knowledge of any issue at all.
That makes it sound like it's just a popularity contest.
Well, down there, football is king.
Yeah.
College football in the South is probably bigger than Green Bay Packers football in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
Like, it's ridiculous. And I like football.
I was going to say, insane. If you're saying it's ridiculous, then it's got to be pretty ridiculous.
Anything else election related?
No, I think we're good. I want people to read our special section because it's beautifully laid out as well. Katie Homan did a
wonderful
fantastic
cover
job
that Katie put together.
Yeah, it looks really beautiful.
Again, that election is April 2nd. That's all you need to know. It's April 2nd.
It is. Tuesday, April 2nd. Yes.
All right. I think we've covered all the bases here for this week anyway. Deb, thanks for hopping on the podcast, You're making welcome. Some time. It's been a very busy few weeks for you, and hopefully a little stress relief now for you.
Yes.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Get out there and vote. Even if you don't live here, go ahead, try and vote. What? Let's.
Miles, no. Cut that. Right.
We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you for listening to the Door County Pulse podcast. This podcast is produced by Miles Danhausen Jr. and edited by the Grammy Award-nominated Hans Christian. No, not nominated for his work on this podcast, but for his album, Ocean Dreaming Ocean. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to check out more of the podcast, visit doorcountypulse.com/podcasts to find our archive of more than 500 episodes featuring local movers and shakers, characters, business owners, authors, musicians, and everyone who helps make this community that we love.